You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 93.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. Aaron, thanks for joining me for part two of our November news update, I guess this is called.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover, so we had to break it into two pieces here.
Well, yeah, I mean, summer's always pretty slow, but now it's going. The summer is usually when I do all my interviews, the summer and the spring. But now the news is coming out, but it's nice to do this every month.
We're in the sprint to New Year's. It'll be over before you know it.
Well, the sprint to the end of the decade. How many, you know, there has to be of like look back at the last decade, predict the next decade, but I don't want to like overdo it. So there's kind of a, I don't know, I still have to decide how many decade flip themed shows I should do.
Well, I makes me wonder what upcoming predictions there are on Metaculous that we could tap into for some inspiration there.
That's true. We have our tech retreat we can look forward to, so there'll be another prediction show.
That's always prediction heavy.
Yeah. So today's going to be, I think this is more of our Local Maximum wheelhouse here. We're going to talk about decentralization and recentralization of technology. We talk about that a lot, but the Wall Street Journal has kind of a their own take on it in a is this an op-ed or is this just a pure news article?
I was just wondering that myself.
Yeah. It's called Tech Giants Have Hijacked the Web. It's time for a reboot. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah,
so it's in their tech section, so it's not labeled as op-ed.
Yep. We are going to be talking about Manning Publishing, who has sponsored the show. You can get all sorts of books on there about that will help you increase your marketability and your skills in computer science and in software engineering and in machine learning and unstructured data for machine learning. And we're also going to talk a little bit about A/B testing today. I'm going to give we're going to talk about an article, and I'm going to give some of my experiences and my my thoughts on the role of A/B testing and how it could be misused. Maybe it's being overused. And if we have time, a little bit of science journalism. So we got a lot to get into. I don't want this to last more than an hour. So why don't we just dive into it?
Okay. So I guess that starts us off with the Wall Street Journal article, which was really the headline was that tech giants have hijacked the web and it's time for a reboot. And so they're looking at kind of whatever the next big, would it be Web 3.0 reinvention are we way past 3.0?
Well, because Web 2.0 was like in 2005, and I don't even think, like, that was maybe some of the social stuff, but it was more like, oh, look at this fancy stuff you could do with JavaScript now where, like, stuff moves over all over the screen. And,
But basically, the monopolies of Google, Facebook, to some extent, maybe Apple. I'm sure they would lump, like, Netflix in there.
Amazon.
Amazon for sure. Yeah. The FANG companies, absolutely. That they control too much of the traffic on the web, and that they have too much of your information that they're holding, internally and proprietary.
No one's sitting there being like, well, this is news, or everyone's saying this is news. Nobody's sitting there saying, whoa, this is news. I never heard that before. so let's go in with the starting quote here and try to break down what do they mean by hijacked and what do they mean by time for a reboot? Because I've been hearing this for 10 years. What does that actually mean? What does that actually look like? And are there any historical examples that we can look back to? So first, I'm going to go with the starting quote. Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg said in a speech last week at Georgetown University that his social media megacorp and its big tech peers, quote, have decentralized power by putting it directly into people's hands. So let's unpack that for a bit, because that's sort of like, whoa, he's saying he decentralized power when really he's centralized power.
As any physicist will tell you, it entirely
takes a lot of nerve.
Frame of reference.
Yeah, it takes a lot of nerve to do that. no, but I think, okay, let's try to unpack what he means by decentralization, because prior to, and I think Twitter is a better example here, Twitter and Blogger, prior to that, I think he's talking about the decentralization of having a voice
Absolutely.
On the web, and the idea that, you know, pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter, you know, you had to be a journalist or a high-level entertainer to get out to large numbers of people. Like, look at this podcast, for example. You know, 1,000 people listen to this podcast every week, and it's just going to go up from there. But even when I started, fine, it was like, you know, it was not that hard to get 20, 30 people if you're well-spoken, if you're interesting. If you want to post up on Facebook, your friends and family can get it immediately. And so that's what I think of when he says it's the decentralization of, you know, decentralization of media, or social media is the decentralization of media.
Yeah, it's which, okay, a lot of everyone people would argue that that's the problem, that we've removed the gatekeepers, and so the quality of content and the veracity of that content becomes more in question.
Yes,
that is maybe a completely different question, but I don't think you can entirely divorce it from what's being discussed here, especially when a paragraph or two in they throw in well, in the second paragraph they throw out references to Russian agents and manipulating the 2016 election, and then there's the quote: "The internet is a corporate monopoly today, and monopolies are always a danger to democracy." So. You can't separate those issues and then make that call.
I'm not liking this article right now. I feel like this article was just written by a computer. It's just like 2016 Russian election.
Paul Vigna, if that is your real name, we're on to you.
Yeah, I know. I feel like this is the Wall Street Journal, right? These are just this whole narrative of Russian election, Cambridge Analytica, danger to democracy. I mean, there's grains of truth in all of that. But
to be fair, the danger to democracy wasn't that. That was actually a quote from a media professor at the University of Westminster, London.
Let's read the full quote here. Capitalizing from the professor, capitalizing on the oceans of data produced by the web has turned Facebook Inc. and Alphabet Inc.'s Google into empires, but it hasn't made the internet a more open place, said Christian Fuchs, a media professor at the University of Westminster in London. The internet is a corporate monopoly today, he said, and monopolies are always a danger to democracy. But I think we have to compare it to what came before. I mean, what came before? Because, okay, actually, now I'm sort of, even though Mark Zuckerberg has some nerve to say that he decentralized power.
He removed some barriers to entry that yes. Before Facebook was as widespread and fully subscribed as it is now. You could put your thoughts out there with a blog or even a podcast in early days, but it required a certain amount of tech savvy to really be able to pull it off.
And Facebook
coming along made it require almost zero knowledge and effort to put your ideas out there.
Yeah, and I can't get behind what the media professor is saying. It hasn't made the internet a more open place. Well, compared to what? Compared to what it was 20 years ago, you're absolutely right. You know, it took a lot of, I mean, I guess it was open because everyone could be, like, all these crazy groups were on there, and they still are. But It depends on your horizon, too.
Because if you look at 20 years ago, absolutely, it's much more open now. If you look at 5-10 years ago, I think there was an explosion between 10 and 5 years ago in the blogosphere, so to speak. And that has largely died off because everything has moved to Twitter and Facebook and the more organized, centralized platforms. So there was an explosion and then a reconsolidation.
That's the history of the world.
If you look far enough back, then absolutely we're in a more open place now than we were then. If you only look a little bit back, then it looks like we've become more constrained.
This is an important point, I think, to make whenever you're having any of these conversations, because you have to talk about what your frame of reference is. Are you comparing to 20 years ago before social media? Are you comparing to the last 5-10 years? Or are you comparing to your imaginary perfect world that doesn't exist? Because the latter is definitely not fair. other than to say this is the way it should work and this is what we can build so that the future works like this. And also, I think it was interesting that you said, you know, explosion and reconsolidation. That is pretty much how markets always work when you have these innovative platforms coming in.
Yeah, and in fact, I was picturing more of a biological evolutionary pattern in there, but I think it holds true that kind of behavior is it's a natural phenomenon, and so it's not at all a surprise to see it in this realm.
What are you thinking in terms of biological?
The type of biology that talks about species and evolution and etymology. No, not is it entomology or
entomology.
Yeah,
I don't know.
One is the root of words, and the other is the evolution of species. But when a breakthrough happens in evolution, you tend to have kind of an explosion in different variations on that theme, and then eventually they will reconsolidate on a smaller set of adaptations that are best suited. But it takes that explosion to present all the possible options, and then the natural, you could almost say market forces of nature will winnow that down to those that are truly most effective, most successful.
No, that's true too. And oftentimes markets and natural ecologies have analogous.
Thank you. Ecology. That's the term we were looking for.
Okay. Yeah, they often have. They often when you analyze one and the analysis is very similar. So it's almost an exploration and then an exploitation of the things that have worked. Cool. So that's interesting. That's an interesting way to think about it.
That gets us to the first note I made on this article was, but it hasn't made the internet a more open place. And in addition to defining your scale and your parameters for your comparison there, how do you measure the openness of the internet? It's a nice term to throw out, and it sounds like openness is good, and why wouldn't we want more of it? But how do you even measure that? Never mind, how do you quantify whether it's something desirable or not? That's left entirely unaddressed.
Yeah, I mean, is the podcasting world more open or less open than it was 5 years ago? It seems like there's a lot of tools to make it easier.
Yeah, there are certainly more podcasts now, but there are also more podcast companies which have podcasts under their umbrella, so you could say that they're perhaps monopolizing what would have previously been the equivalent of kind of mom and pop podcast organizations.
Yeah, well, that hasn't happened with podcasts yet. Same way that it has happened with Facebook, Twitter, and
certainly not to that extent. But you have you have like Gimlet, which is kind of a podcast umbrella, well, which is corporate Spotify and now. Is now part of Spotify, and there are similar. Podcast collectives almost gives it too much of a freewheeling socialist commune feel to it, but networks with a strong corporate bent. So is it Gas Digital?
Sure.
Which is
they're tiny.
They're comparatively tiny, but they're very much a business. It's not just a bunch of podcasters who got together and said, "Oh, we'll cross promote each other a little bit."
Right. I mean, then there's a lot. There's all the political ones too.
Yeah.
There's the right wing ones. There's the left wing ones. What's the
and then there's
Daily Wire and
Sirius
and Joe Rogan's just huge and all that.
And then there's satellite radio, which is basically a podcast network with a much more expensive and wide reaching infrastructure.
Okay, but you're kind of proving the point now that how decentralized it is because of how many players there are and how fluid it is, at least in this particular point in time. With regard to podcasting. But the internet in general maybe is different because I think when they say hijack the web, I think what they're talking about is people spend all their time on the web. Where do people spend all their time on the web? And it's almost always all, you know, Google, Facebook, Twitter.
There's the whole walled garden concept and there was the big argument that started being made a couple of years ago that no longer do people actually go to websites. They go to these environments. So your Facebooks I'm drawing a blank on what the others would be. But similar, your Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they're not going to websites. They're going to these services, which are either in the form of an app, you can access through them through the web, but it's not web traffic that's driving it. And once you get there, you tend to stay inside it and navigate around internally.
It's interesting how this is kind of similar to, you know, the way people first got on the web in the 90s when you're talking about, you know, the AOL's walled garden and
or CompuServe or whatever else there was.
And then that broke apart and then reconsolidated again. And by the way, I think this happens again. It's not like it. There's an explosion and a consolidation. That doesn't mean there's not another explosion right around the corner, which I believe there absolutely could be.
You have to expect it'll be a continuous cycle until it stops.
Yeah.
And there's no way of telling when that's going to stop.
Yeah, so let's move forward a little bit. Let's talk about this article talks a little bit about the Tim Berners-Lee plan. Is that the only one they talk about, or they talk about others too? So we talked a little bit about this back in episode 36. He wants to build in Silicon Valley style, a new internet. But hey, he's the inventor of the World Wide Web, so he has a lot of credibility on that one.
Yeah, and so this is the concept of what he refers to as a pod, which it sounds like would essentially be a place where your personal data is stored, and it can be linked in with services so that they can utilize it, but that you retain the data. And it's unclear exactly how that's going to work. And I don't know if that's because the Wall Street Journal chose not to discuss that or doesn't understand it, or if the team developing it at Inrupt hasn't totally figured it out themselves yet.
I'll tell you how it works. I don't know if all of the sirens are coming out. There's all sorts of high crime and everything in Brooklyn these days, and lots of noise pollution. But okay, so the way a pod would work is it's essentially you're owning your own server. So you have let's use Facebook as an example, all right? So instead of logging onto Facebook, you have a machine. Let's say it's in your home. I know this sounds crazy. This is the way I'm going to describe it is going to sound crazy, and you're not going to do it. But then we're going to adjust it so that it sounds less crazy. Let's say you have a machine in your home that when somebody goes to your Facebook page, your Facebook wall, or just wants to know what your comments are on different message boards, they would have to hit your server. And so their message gets sent to your server, and then you know who's getting your information and all that stuff. And then, basically it's decentralized in that everybody is running their own server with their own information on it. In much the same way, like everybody can run in their own house a server that hosts their own website on it. Now, nobody is going to want to do that, you know, from their own home and personally.
Certainly not to scale.
Yeah, yeah. I shouldn't say nobody. I mean, plenty of people would. But in general, there would have to be a service where you would log on and then you would kind of request one of these machines that they have in their data center that is, quote, yours. I mean, it's not really yours, but it's essentially going to be the one that only you have access to. And that is sort of your slice of the new Facebook or the new Twitter or whatever it is that goes out to the world. In some ways, I don't see the benefit to that much, different than what goes on now. But I think the big benefit is the end of, you know, it's sort of the end of the big data model. The question is, could it be, you're not going to do this by just building a new Facebook or building a new Twitter. Nobody is going to use that system to do the same thing that they could do now and just say, oh, well, we're not going to give you ads and we're going to charge you and we're not going to track you and all that. I don't think you're going to get a lot of people. But if you could get some system like that, some decentralized system where everybody has their data on their own machine or something that's like their own machine but, you know, controlled externally, which purists aren't going to like, but, you know, it's not going to work. I don't know if you agree or disagree. It's not going to work any other way, folks.
It'll have to be virtualized, yeah.
Yeah, there has to be some kind of like a bank that you go to. Like, you know, you keep your money in a bank and it's safe. You keep your server in a server bank and it's safe there. It has to be some other application other than social networking.
Well, so the there are a number of questions this raises, but one of them is, would it, if this is in some way replacing Facebook,
I don't think it would replace Facebook.
But that's certainly the way they're pitching it is as a replacement. And what I wonder is, would it be able to interface with that, or would it require you moving to a completely new, you know, whatever it is? So, because I think without a major disruption in the market, and I hate myself for using that hackneyed phrase, you're not going to get people to pick up and leave Facebook. But if you could have a way for them to interface with it, which from their end would feel seamless, but that would allow them to have control over their data so that it can't be farmed by Facebook, that would be attractive. But I don't think if Facebook can still interact with your data, what's to stop them from scraping it from your pod? I'm sure there's a way to do that, but it doesn't seem immediately apparent to me how you could get the same experience that you currently have without giving anything up.
I guess the idea would be that in order to scrape from your pod, you wouldn't just be putting stuff out there into the public. You would use some public-private cryptography. So if I send a message to you, for example, only you would be able to read it. Now, the problem with, you know, Facebook friends only, now the friends are a much larger group of people. But, right. Yeah.
Well, if there's some sort of algorithm that needs to run on your data, I can't imagine that Facebook is going to send the algorithm to your pod and let you run it there if that's some sort of proprietary piece of code, and it would defeat the purpose of the pod for them to send a request and you just send them the data that they want to input into that.
It wouldn't work. And if you wanted to get the user experience that Facebook has, it would be nowhere near as good. And I hate to say that Facebook has a good user experience, but it would be a total mess.
The other issue, and you hinted at this, is if they're not using your data to somehow monetize it, then they have to make money somehow. So presumably, the hosting of a pod, even if you're hosting the pod yourself on your own server in your house,
can you stop for a second? I hate the term pod because it sounds like podcast, but sorry, go ahead. We're talking about your server. These guys are not marketing guys who are creating this.
I'm sure that POD is an acronym for something.
Yeah.
It's your personal online data. There we go.
Okay.
So
that's not any good. Better.
If your personal online data is being hosted, even in your own home and your own server, you're running their software. So you've got to license that somehow, presumably. Or if you're running it on a virtualized server in some server farm somewhere, you've got to pay for those resources. Does that come in the form of a subscription? Or do you then go and resell your data to chosen vendors and use that to pay for your server costs, and then whatever extra is left over, you can collect as kind of a bonus. Not unlike people with solar panels on their house, where if they produce more than they use, they get a credit from the power company.
Yeah. Well, so I should also note, I should also note, like when I was at NYU, a bunch of students there started a company called Diaspora, which is this distributed social network. And I believe that their nodes are also called pods. And so, it's still around, and they started building this in 2010, but it did not, it didn't dethrone Facebook in any meaningful way. I mean,
you need some sort of lightning strike event to get that kind of thing to catch on in the way it would need to get the momentum.
Like I said, it has to be something completely different from the problem that Facebook solves. Okay, any more on that?
One other thing they talk about is not just decentralizing your data, but also decentralizing, the processing involved here. So spreading this out not just into server farms and to servers in your own homes, but to other people, basically turning everybody else's devices on the wider web into the cloud.
Well, processing what? I mean, so every company out there is paying Amazon servers and all that to process their big data. If you want to sell part of your computation time, someone could set that up, fine, you know. But
well, I think that's the idea, because you don't want Amazon doing it, because when it's all done through Amazon, then they can scrape that and use that data for improving their algorithms and doing whatever they're doing.
I don't know if they do. I mean, you think that the stuff that Foursquare or whoever puts through Amazon...
That I don't know about. Yeah. But for example, we do know that if you use Gmail, that while a human Googler may not be reading your email, that they're basically scraping every single email that goes through their email servers to use it for training their machine learning algorithms for predictive email writing and spam sorting and everything else. So they've got a giant log somewhere of every email that you've sent and received. And I'm not saying that decentralizing that solves that problem. In fact, I think it opens a whole new can of worms related to that.
Yeah.
But some people would be attracted to the idea of taking that out of the hands of the almighty Google and breaking that up somehow.
Yeah. How many people email themselves their passwords? And so what if it's like...
Or how many people save those in a Google Doc?
Yeah. So what if my suggestion is... I'm just typing along and all of a sudden my suggestion is, hello, Aaron Bell, your password for Amazon is this. I'm like, oh, I just got his password. Awesome. I'll just put it in. So maybe it's his Netflix password. I'm pretty sure.
I would never share a Netflix password.
I'm pretty sure that's not going to be a problem, but, it's funny to think about, right? If they do scrape that for that kind of data, okay.
I'll throw out one final note on this, and that's that kind of in the beginning and at the end, they pose the question of if these are indeed monopolies, then maybe there needs to be some sort of regulation, a regulatory action taken, and I think you pulled the quote here that. This in itself may pose a regulatory challenge. However, since it would enable autonomous interactions online, law enforcement's anonymous interaction online, law enforcement's job is easier when dealing with companies with centralized data, not individuals. Yada yada yada. So there are a couple of thoughts related to that. One,
well, hold on. The last sentence is really interesting. It says the U.S., U.K., and Australia jointly asked Facebook to delay adding encryption to its messaging services for law enforcement purposes.
Yeah, and I think it was earlier. Was it earlier this year that they added end-to-end encryption to Facebook Messenger and made a big deal of that? I'm sure they didn't advertise that this is coming, 6 to 12 months later than planned because of the requests to the intelligence community.
Right.
But and I don't quote me on that. I'm not saying that those are the actual delays. That's. Just a supposition there. But I think from in terms of regulation, there are a couple of thoughts here. One is that if these are indeed dangerous monopolies, then maybe there's a way to break them up with regulation. However, if you're looking for a way to break the paradigm to retake the web from these tech giants, to bring about a reboot, putting more regulation in place is exactly the way to kind of kill in the cradle these innovative ideas that might be coming up, because regulation in this case is absolutely going to benefit the incumbents. There's no regulation that's going to pass that. It may make a weaker Facebook, but it's going to make them stronger compared to anybody else trying to break into the market.
And that's all they care about.
It's going to entrench. They may and it's also going shrink to... their footprint, but they're going to fortify that position.
Right. It's going to also... be written with the assumption with the companies in mind that already exist.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to do something new, then the regulations won't. It will apply to them, but it won't apply well. Like it won't be. It will be very awkward. Just like talk about net neutrality is the idea that the regulations on the telecom companies should apply to. The internet service providers, which is, is not the same thing.
Yeah, and that's become much more of a viable line of thought now that we've moved from the era when anybody could start up an ISP in their neighborhood. Well, not anybody, but anybody tech savvy to compete with the other options out there. To most markets are lucky if you have two reliable ISP options.
Yeah. Well, we should return to net neutrality one day because we've been without it for a year or so, and we'll see if the world is destroyed. Okay.
Well, some would argue that the world has already basically been destroyed, and we're just waiting for the other foot to drop. But
yeah,
let's drop that and walk away from it.
Yeah. None of these problems with the internet are because of the lack of net neutrality. No, like no one says, oh, Facebook has hijacked the web thanks to you know, Trump's regulation, removing net neutrality or something like that.
The internet was just as broken before Trump. It was maybe less of a dumpster fire, but just as broken.
Yeah. Okay. So what else do we have here? Just an interesting like side note. I talked about Stefan Molyneux a couple episodes ago. That guy is getting so annoying online. he was particularly annoying last. I mean, sometimes he says things I agree with, but anyway, PayPal cut off his donations, which is interesting. It kind of shows how where they're starting to draw lines in regard to, okay, we can kick you off social networks, we could deplatform you, we could demonetize you, and now we could even say, you know, you can't receive payments from us. Obviously, with the emergence of cryptocurrency, that's going to be irrelevant soon, but I thought that was interesting. The first thing I thought was, you know, no, I'm having too much fun debunking all his fallacies and dead-end ideas. So now I can't spread around the fodder for debunking, but oh well.
Yeah, I had a couple of thoughts on this, most of which were just tearing into the author of the article for not taking a neutral tack on this, which maybe I shouldn't be expecting that from Newsweek. But there were a couple of things in there. First, the referring to this as being quote unquote fan gifts, I thought that was a dismissive and pejorative.
What's a fan gift?
Well, these quote unquote donations that he's getting through PayPal.
I see.
I think for a growing number of people, this is becoming a legitimate business model.
It is legitimate.
And to call it fan gifts, it sounds like someone's sending him creepy fan mail with 20s slipped into it. And particularly, how different is this than people who are using Kickstarter or Indiegogo or Patreon to fund their work? I think it's, if anything, it's a slightly less structured and more traditional, because PayPal has been around for I don't know how long, I'm going to ballpark a decade longer than those services. So I think it was unfair to paint everybody who funds their work through PayPal as just getting fan gifts. Another thing was the author referred to a number of sensationalist titles for his YouTube videos, which maybe this is showing like my personal bias. I didn't think they were that sensational.
Yeah. The author just wants everyone to know that they're not a white nationalist and they don't agree Molyneux's views. Fine. I'm on the same side.
I'm fully willing to grant that maybe the content of these videos was sensationalist, because I did not watch a single one.
Yeah.
But a video titled "The Truth About Canada's Election, Part One, Immigration." That sounds like it could be the title of a Frontline episode, not a sensationalist YouTube episode.
Yeah, but then, well, look, I mean, you're not going to go in there and listen to it, but I don't even want to get into it. You could imagine.
So that gets me to something else, which was the author dropped in there that there was an episode on the flat Earth conspiracy debate.
So
which, the way he mentioned it, made it sound very much like Stefan Molyneux is a huge proponent of flat Earth theory, which I'm guessing is not the case.
No,
you can fill me in on more detail here.
I regrettably listened to that one. Actually, no, what he did was actually kind of interesting. He brought someone who believed in flat Earth onto his show to debate them, But he didn't really debate them. Instead of debating them, he started to like psychoanalyze him. And he was like, well, what is it about you that you need to feel that the earth is flat? And started, it was weird.
So that poses an interesting question of when is it appropriate to make ad hominem attacks? And is the situation where the person that you're debating against is clearly off their rocker justification
it was interesting.
For that?
Look, in terms of getting interesting podcast or interesting YouTube video content, like that was not a bad idea. Trying to actually figure out why these people believe what they believe. It was a little bit interesting, but I don't want to push people to that one. But
sure.
So to
maybe step away from the specifics of Molyneux and to the larger question here, with electronic payment processors and payment systems, so your MasterCards or your PayPals or whatnot. On the one hand, these are private companies, and so if they decide that they don't want to be affiliated with certain individuals or certain organizations, that is their right. However, they are becoming a very significant connective tissue in the modern economy. In a world where fewer and fewer transactions are happening every day with face-to-face interaction, and certainly less and less with cash, it's easy to make an argument at least as strong as that of, well, Facebook is the, you know, the town square of the internet, and therefore it should be regulated with First Amendment rights in mind. Then I think you can make a at least as strong argument that these electronic payment services should not be discriminating based on the views of their customers.
You know,
long as they're not outright breaking law. So obviously, if someone is engaging in illegal activities such as arms smuggling or child pornography or things along those lines, then I think that it is not only right, but it is should be required of these companies to cooperate with law enforcement. But for political reasons, it makes me feel a little bit squishy and uncomfortable.
Sure. Sure.
At the same time, I'm also squishy and uncomfortable with having the government come in and tell them what they have to do.
Yeah, no, the whole narrative of we've got to break up companies, people form opinions of, oh, you got to break up this company and that company. And I bet those people couldn't name like three divisions within those companies and what their products do, you know. And so it's just this narrative they push out like, hey, the government has to keep breaking up companies. Otherwise, otherwise the public interest in democracy is going to be ruined. When really I just feel that I feel the antitrust stuff, even though it sounds good, it's always a scam. so I just want to move on from that. All right. Manning Publishing. Have you learned, Aaron, you've learned quite a bit about machine learning and deep learning on this podcast, I assumed. I've learned quite a bit too, even though I was coming in as the person who did this. But there is always a chance to learn more and to apply these ideas in the real world. So you remember in episode 87, I had Mark Ryan on the show to talk about his book, Deep Learning with Structured Data. Deep Learning with Structured Data. You can get that on Manning.com with the discount code PODLOCALMAX19. You'll get 40% off that book and every other book on Manning.com. You could just go there and apply it. Manning.com has a lot of really great textbooks on everything from the basics of computer science, how to, textbooks on different programming languages, different frameworks, and other mathematical and technical topics. So it will, if you just want to learn more and become an expert in one of these areas, getting a book at Manning.com is a great place to start. If you want to dive into software engineering, give yourself some more marketable skills, or build something, build software, build a website yourself, buying one of these books will be really helpful. So Manning.com, PODLOCALMAX19 is the discount code. We have a lot of Manning books in our Foursquare library at work, and it would make and a great addition to your work library. Sometimes you could even expense it if you're an engineer at your company, which means that you'll essentially get access to it for free. But PodLocalMax19 to get 40% off, learn computer science, learn technical frameworks, and make your job skills more marketable.
And they've got titles and categories ranging from, it looks like, Android to web development. So
that's a big one.
A lot to cover there.
Yeah, I mean, it's been so hard to find good iOS engineers. We're always short iOS and Android engineers at Foursquare. I know a lot of other companies are. So that's another area where there's big room for growth.
So hot industry tip for those developers yeah. out there who might be looking for a way into Foursquare.
Yeah. All right. So, iPhone, Android, absolutely. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about A/B testing. So for those of you who don't know, A/B testing is when the owner of an app or a website or some other service will actually create two versions of the service or multiple versions of that service and then run kind of a randomized control trial where some people see the background in green, for example, other people see the background in purple, or maybe some people see the buy button in green, other people see the buy button in purple, and then they measure, you know, which people took the action they cared about more. And so A/B testing is something that a lot of companies like to brag about. A lot of big companies tend to do it a lot. And I want to question, you know, what is the proper use of A/B testing in this industry? Is it overused? So here's the main quote from the article. The article that we read is from the Daily Grit, which is a paper on brands. Now, why do brands care about A/B testing? So from the point of view of brands, they're trying to figure out, how people see their company or their product, and they want to show it, usually visually, but it could be in other ways, in different ways, and see how different people respond. And so the main quote from the article from the Daily Grit is, that means that, the main question is A/B testing dead? And the quote is, that means online entrepreneurs can no longer just sit in their offices and A/B test their landing page without ever contacting a member of their audience directly. They're now expected to build fan bases and sell on the strength of their own personality. They have to build personal connections. So they're essentially saying that A/B testing doesn't work anymore, if it ever did. I think that there was a time when it didn't work, but the general, it was over-relied upon as a winning strategy. A/B testing, in my opinion, is not a strategy. You can't just sit around changing the color of your buttons, changing the color of your background, moving things around. You might make something slightly easier to use, and sometimes it's worth using, doing that research, but that cannot be the core of your business. Because think about it, that's not the core of the value that you're adding. Unless the value that you're adding is entirely based on user experience, then yes, there has to be some A/B testing involved, but you're not going to mastermind your user experience by A/B testing chiefly. Essentially, you'll have some expert come out with, like, do some research on their own or do some creative processing on their own and try to figure out what a really good user interface would be. And then you could A/B test that against what you have. But generally,
I think some of these use cases they may be thinking about are much narrower than the way you're perceiving, because you're coming at this from kind of an app development perspective almost.
That's true, because there's apps and there's brands and
they're thinking of almost more of a kind of a referral marketing perspective, where they're not necessarily providing anything unique other than they're trying to attract you to this other product that they're trying to sell you. And so they don't, maybe if they don't own the product, so they can't improve the quality of the product itself. All they can do is try and improve the odds of when a customer sees their, whether it's their landing page or their ad or whatever, that what gets me a higher conversion from viewing to clicking the buy button.
Well, that's cool too. Like your A/B
testing.
And
if you're restricted to just that narrow window of opportunity, this might make sense. But there are definitely, if you have more control over the product and the full pipeline, then there are absolutely more effective ways to focus your energy on improvement.
Right. So just in general, it might be okay. It's not a bad idea to A-B test your sales pitch, you know, and see which works and which doesn't. But first you have to write some good sales pitches.
Fair enough, yeah.
And that, you know, and you actually have to understand what value people are bringing and, you know, try to do it that way. You can't just sit around and say, oh, I'm going to test different colors and different synonyms for this one word in my sale, in my marketing email, and then eventually, over time, I'll get customers. First of all, you know, a lot of these tests get very small improvement. If this stuff gets a 0.1% improvement, then it might make sense for large corporations. So I know I'm coming out of the sales pitch again and going back into user interface, but you know, Microsoft, Netflix does a lot of A/B testing. If you get a 0.1% improvement in the number of people who don't cancel their subscription from a slight change to the interface, then okay, fine, it's maybe worth paying a few engineers, like giving, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a budget to that. But
well, yeah, there was an interesting story a while back. Netflix had an anthology series. I don't know if you've seen it. I think it was Love, Death, and Robots. And
no.
They didn't randomize the order the episodes were shown, but I think there were three different orders that they could be served up to you. And I think they said that it was random which order you got, but there was a lot of speculation that they may have been using data about your viewing habits and what they knew about you to perhaps provide you the episodes in an order that was be more likely to get you hooked, which they denied actually doing that. But the potential for doing that kind of thing has a lot of interesting opportunities there.
Yeah, but that is really, I think, works a lot more at scale. Like I said, if you have a lot
Absolutely.
Of customers already, if you're trying to if you're a small company and you're trying to get customer by customer or even in the hundreds or thousands, then getting this 1% improvement is not going to be a big deal for you. You actually have to understand what people are going for, and you actually have to create the product or the sales pitch. Also, another just from an automation perspective, A/B tests are really, really slow to get feedback. I mean, some of the A/B tests that we ran at Foursquare, it could be a month, like weeks at least, before there were significant results on whether A was better than B, or
just in terms of collecting enough volume of data.
Right, right, and that is, and also a lot of times A/B tests are run because managers want to see A/B tests, but in the end, they've already made up their minds, and no matter how the test result, whatever happens with the test result, the same decision is going to be made anyway. And so that's a lot of expense for no reason.
Well, I can see one of the attractive things about A/B testing is that it is showing you actual results, as opposed to when you survey your users, the answer they give may not necessarily map directly to how they would actually behave in that situation. Much
right.
like in the context of politics, exit polling does not equal election results.
Right. And so
and pre-election polling certainly doesn't equal election results.
No, but I think there could be some kind of system where if you want to build a truly intelligent, like, user interface, let's say, you could actually have the interface, you know, you could have the computer show people several different interfaces and have it evolve the interface over time based on its best Bayesian guess on the small amount of data that it gets from those few people. So that would be an interesting
idea. Are you suggesting a UI design by machine learning?
Well, it's just an interesting idea that you can actually have something work. I mean, look, it would be very difficult to set that system up. I'm not saying that it's just an easy thing that everyone at their company should just go ahead and do. But I just think it's an interesting idea, because if these A/B tests are frequent statistics, require a lot of data, can take a lot of time, is very slow, it would be interesting if you had more like a flexible system that, you know, made inferences based on a few data points, which means that it didn't actually make the inference of whether A is better than B, but it gets the probability distribution over how much A is better than B or vice versa, and then kind of moves on and sort of builds a model of how people behave. That I'm sure that companies try that too. But I think I think the trick with A/B tests in a smaller situation, in a bigger company, they're running them all the time because those small improvements get a lot of money. I think that there's like a cult of A/B testing that definitely should not be brought into smaller companies. You should only run them periodically for the big changes you want to make.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's the curse of being a fairly easy to understand thing because you can present this to someone who does not have a deep background in statistics. They can get what's going on, and so they will be much more likely to come back to that tool and use it again and again because they feel that they can understand it.
Yeah.
And you know, your marketing manager is much less likely to keep asking for some sort of more complex analysis that they don't completely understand and aren't as comfortable with.
Yeah.
So it's straightforwardness is perhaps a weakness in that it allows for it to be vastly overutilized. It's become a crutch.
Right. And like I said, it's often overridden. It's because people don't want to take responsibility for their decisions. I mean, that's my take on it a lot of the time. Not that it shouldn't be used, but I mean, it's interesting how it used to be one of these things where A/B tests was sort of sort of considered the gold standard, and people have backed off because a lot of these things that start off as good ideas end up becoming doctrine, and then they end up becoming like, you know, I don't want to use the word cult again, but I want to use what's the word I want to use? It ends up becoming common, like just an overused cliche, or not necessarily cliche, just something that what's something that everyone believes just because everyone believes it.
I know what you mean, but I can't think of the right word for it. Yeah.
I know there's a good word for it, but okay. But anyway,
it's more like, than common knowledge. It's a mass hallucination.
Yeah, but it's not a hallucination. It's just like a mass ideology that everyone holds, and then it gets used to this crazy extent, and then all of a sudden, a few years later, people forget about it. And so it just makes you think about how, like, a lot of the stuff that we're told day to day about how, oh, this is the way our company should be run, this is the way you should run your life, this is, are just kind of passing fads that maybe have a grain of truth to them, but maybe shouldn't be taken too seriously.
Yeah, well, and there's of course the structural problem to A/B testing, that if the best solution to a problem isn't A or B, you're not going to discover that with A/B testing.
Right. And that was a problem with the ads, with working on attribution and Fourscore, the ads too, which, you know, companies didn't want to run A/B tests. They didn't want to run, you know, tests where they didn't show ads to people. How could we not show ads to people?
I guess that's much like in the pharmaceutical business with placebo tests and clinical trials. It's if you have a medication or a vaccine or something that you are convinced is going to save lives, then how could you ethically choose to not give it to a group of people who desperately need it? It's not as bad as doing double blind tests where you're intentionally infecting people with something terrible to see if it, you know, or making people smoke cigarettes to see if it actually has a negative effect on their health. But it's the other side of that coin.
Yeah. All right, so just to close this one out, you weren't happy with the way at the end of this article.
Yeah, well, so we were very focused on A/B testing, what it is, why it may or may not work, but they were proposing that they were basically jumping to the conclusion that it's broken, it doesn't work, we're not getting the results out of what we want, and so the solution is that we need to be following much more of a kind of an influencer model. And so in order to convert these sales,
gotcha,
you need to be building a cult of personality and using your reputation to sell, that is certainly a methodology that works.
Wonder if that's going to become the next, overdone thing.
I mean, in terms of Instagram influencers, I think it's it already is. but I don't think we're going to see it disappear entirely.
Yeah.
But so... One of the things they said that is you need to find products that you're actually passionate about, that you actually care about and enjoy, because your audience can sense the fakeness if you're just shilling for something that you don't actually believe in. And so they said that finding things that you care about, that you believe in, it's not, and choosing to sell those, quote, that's not just straightforward, it's also easy. Which I kind of thought was BS. And it made me think of that whole mantra that, you know, find a way to do what you love for a job, and you'll never work a day in your life. To which I've always asserted that the corollary is that if you get a job doing something you love, you will grow to hate it.
Very negative, Aaron.
Well, if you got a job as a professional chocolate taster and you had to taste chocolate for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, you would eventually get pretty sick of chocolate.
I guess you're right.
I'm taking a very jaded view there,
I went to the chocolate factory here in Brooklyn. It's over there. I'm pointing out the window, like I'm actually seeing where it was, and the people there seem pretty happy in the chocolate factory.
Yeah, well, and the delicious people at Ben and Jerry's get to take home 2 pints a day, but it doesn't take long before you're trying to pawn those off on friends and relatives, because if you eat 2 pints of Ben and Jerry's ice cream a day, you're gonna wish that they use that employee benefit towards a gym in the factory.
I don't know if they have a gym in the factory. I think it's also a struggle to find something you like for work, and especially in software. I think there's a lot of tasks, a lot of jobs in software development that are not as much fun, and it's a constant battle to not have to do those things all the time.
Yeah, and it's certainly not all glamour.
So find a job that's something you love is something I agree with, but it's a constant fight to get there, which is not easy. Which is maybe a little less negative than your corollary, but still not as far. And also, I don't think it's straightforward either. You have to ask yourself, which products do you like? And you want to, in this case, it's what do you want to sell? But I think that it equally applies to, well, what do you want to work for? You want to work for a company that you believe in, has products you believe in, and, that are interesting to you. That is not an entirely straightforward question. People kind of assume it is. Like people, you know, when you're in college and you're about to graduate, and people are like, oh, what are you interested in? And a lot of people don't have a good answer. A lot of people have a stock answer that will get those questions off their back. But it's not what they really believe, or what they're, you know, a lot of people are just not as sure as other people think they are.
Yeah, well, if that makes sense. I'm gonna throw this to a topic that we absolutely don't have time to cover today, but that we should hit on in the future. A lot of people talk about universal basic income in that context. That, well, if you were guaranteed to have everything you needed to survive on, then you would truly be free to pursue what you really care about, your true passion. And I think most of us would have nowhere to go. We'd have no idea where to start with that process if all of a sudden the burden of taking care of our needs was lifted from us, and we had to figure out what to do with ourselves to satisfy our wants purely on that basis. So yeah, that's a door I'll leave open for future discussion, because I think at least as long as Andrew Yang stays in the primaries, universal basic income is going to be a ripe issue for discussion for a while.
People are going to keep bringing it up over and over. I think
he's certainly not the first one to raise it.
And he won't be the last. All right, so I just want to go touch on your one bullet point on the end. What are you talking about with the modernized home shopping?
So this idea of that it's about people that we recognize. So whether it's the inventors of a product or somebody else who's vested in it coming to us and giving a live demonstration or an impassioned talk about why this is a good product and why you should buy it. It made me think a lot about the early days of the home shopping network, where you literally have the person who invented a newfangled mop or handmade dog beds or something, and they come on the show and they they display their products and they talk about why you should buy them, and they clearly care about it because they're invested in it literally and emotionally, and that convinces people to then purchase it. And that's kind of the business model that they're talking about here, replacing the what was perhaps previously filled by this somewhat mercenary A/B testing approach. And I don't know that that's really that. Certainly elements of that are going to be with us for a long time, but I think what they're proposing is really a hearkening back to an age that had a different kind of captive audience. And for anyone younger than the boomer generation, I don't think it's going to translate quite the same way they think it does.
Yeah. I really hate these.
Not to
okay
jump
boomer
on the okay boomer. Yeah.
I am not a fan of those memes. First of all, everyone's going to get older at some point. And so what
are we?
Well, I think that the people who are using or overusing the OK boomer memes are themselves going to be the ones most affected by the, hey, get a load of these old people these days when they grow old, because they're
I'm
focused
waiting
on their
for
own
that,
generation.
That critical inflection point where millennial goes from being like a, hey, you kids get off of my lawn, to a, oh, those old farts, pejorative, because it's gonna happen.
Yeah, it will happen one day.
And I guess are we technically on the would it be the far or the near? We're
the
earliest millennials. Yeah.
And the right now the Generation Z.
It's a label that I refuse to accept.
Yeah, the Generation Z is calling themselves Zoomers. Yes, I don't like millennial, particularly since we're bunched in with the younger millennials, who are the ones that have the most the most stereotypical millennial thing are not people born in the mid-80s. It's mostly people born in the
For the record, boomers, millennials, even the greatest generation, you are not welcome on my lawn. So unless you have an invitation, get off my lawn.
A silent generation, no? So,
They can silently stay off my lawn.
Okay. I assume that whatever generation is after Gen Z is going to be your kids' friends, so they will probably be on your lawn.
They should call first.
Okay, good.
on my landline, because I'm going to get one just to be an old fart.
All right. Is that what happens now? Or, you know, that's not how it works. It's not like we get older and then we get the landline and then we get even older and then we start getting into vinyl records. It's going to be something else. And then the stuff that we use that seems new is going to seem old.
I have been toying with the idea of picking up another typewriter, but I've had at least one for a long time. Someone threw out a crazy, factoid the other day that was I think the last typewriters ceased manufacture. I think it was a factory in India, and it was far later than I thought. It was like the early 2000s. So we are only starting to see kids in graduating high school now who were born after the last typewriter was manufactured.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. I had a typewriter in my elementary school.
I remember writing. We had to borrow the next door neighbor's electric typewriter, which was super fancy because it was electric.
But it's weird because there were also computers at the same time. So they're like, sometimes you use the computer, but you can also use the typewriter to type, which is another valid way to type. And then after kindergarten, first grade, they're like, yeah, it's typewriter. We don't really see the need for it anymore.
But it was a legitimate overlap, unlike fax machines, which have somehow still held on into some very weird niches.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of stuff that Gen Z uses that to us is going to seem strange, have you heard of TikTok at all?
I have, and I refuse to get any closer than I already am.
Well, I mean, so I am not. I'm getting so many updates about TikTok. That's the new social media. I mean, I really liked Vine, which was the short videos that ended up getting bought by Twitter. And so, people are always going to find different media to communicate.
What was the other videos? Was it Periscope? Does that still exist, or did that get swallowed up into something else entirely?
I think Periscope was part of Twitter. I'm not sure. I think those eventually got shut down. They just weren't as – that was live video. It wasn't as interesting as they thought it would be. And essentially Facebook and Instagram and others have live video.
I would tar the entire social media with that label, not as interesting as they thought it would be. But
you might be right.
I'm just one grumpy old man, as we've clearly established.
Well, that's good. Some people need to hear from that. All right, I'm going to leave it there. We went off on a few tangents maybe, but only because we're having a lot of fun doing it. If I made some off-the-cuff statement on a tangent that's maybe a little bit, I'm sure I'll hear from you on that. localmaxradio@gmail.com if you want to call me out for anything I said. We also brought up a couple of news articles that talk about, quote, new studies say, you know, there are a lot of articles like that. And it's always good to step back and think about how much stock we should put in these and how much these types of articles are actually already affecting our day-to-day decisions. And so I'll put that in a later episode, either next week or as a bonus, because that was another interesting discussion I had with Aaron. And finally, you know, I have a little bit of break between guests. I have a few guests, you know, starting back up again in December. But next week, I want to do something. I want to start discussing a topic that I've been thinking deeply about for over 20 years. And that's it's a mathematical topic. And that's the nature of infinity and what the practical implications are for this abstract concept. There are a bunch of different ways to approach infinity. There are a bunch of different meanings. So this is going to take several episodes, but it's going to start next week, and it's going to be practical. It's going to get you thinking about the mathematical world and the probabilistic world in a different way, I think. And I hope you'll join me to see what I have to say about it. Solo show next week. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account at Max Sklar. Have a great week. Feel the power.